This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A physicist, a leading expert on clean energy and climate, he was an advisor in the Clinton administration. His book, Hell and High Water, becomes too true daily. Time magazine called him the web's most influential climate change blogger. Dr. Joseph Rome's Climate Progress is the only blog right on my browser toolbar. It is indispensable. Joe Rome, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for your hard work. Let's dive right in. Despite our efforts, science seems to show humanity progressing towards a difficult, even calamitous future. I'd like to get your reaction to the report from the British Royal Society, that theme issue, Beyond 4 Degrees.
Yeah, that's a pretty alarming issue. I will say that many of us have, for quite some time, been saying that climate scientists need to start looking at what happens if humanity doesn't take any action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Scientists, I think, quite rightly had expected humanity would take action by now. So they've mostly been modeling sort of here's what happens if you take action. But people should understand the worst case scenario, and that is that the planet warms 7 degrees Fahrenheit or more this century. And the consequences are quite dramatic. I think everybody in the glaciology community believes that sea levels would rise 3, 4, maybe 5 feet, and then keep rising. I think that there's an understanding that you're going to get more extreme weather. I mean, we've only warmed about a degree Fahrenheit in the past 50 years. And we're already seeing extreme weather in places like Nashville and Moscow and Pakistan. So when you warm 7 times that much or 8 times as much, you're going to see a lot more extreme weather. And I think one of the points that the there's sort of two key points that the issue makes, one of which is that, you know, in the worst case scenario, this amount of warming could come considerably earlier than most people realized. It could come as early as the 2060s. That's not likely to happen, but people need to think hard about it. The second thing is that we often focus on sort of how much humans are going to respond to this, and of course humans are very adaptable, but most species, you know, they're not as adaptable. And so entire ecosystems could easily collapse. And of course, humans do rely on ecosystems for much of their food. I mean, a very good example of what could happen is what might happen to oceans and acidification, which is a loss, a significant amount of the food chain in oceans. And I'm thinking of specifically marine life, coral reefs, you know, which are the home to much of the biodiversity in the ocean. Phytoplankton, it turns out, we've lost about 40% of phytoplankton in the last 50 years, and they are the cornerstone of the entire marine food chain. So the oceans are getting hotter, more acidic, we're overfishing them. There's a grave risk of a mass extinction of marine life.
Well, let's look a little bit at the political responses. You know, the Canadian government is now kind of the bad guy. We try to stop international action on carbon emissions. Our government muzzles climate scientists. You know, we just had a thing where we called off the scientific research program into climate damage in our vast Arctic, and instead we're going to lease the climate research ship to the oil companies to find more oil in the melting Arctic. We can't get much lower, Joe, but how about your country? Do you expect more denial or maybe even investigations of climate scientists?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It looks like North America is going in the wrong direction. Unfortunately, in the most recent November election, we Americans put a lot of people who deny basic climate science and who oppose clean energy action into Congress. And so I think the prospects of any serious action by the United States over the next couple of years are pretty minuscule.
And it doesn't look like China's doing much. We hear a lot about clean energy projects there, but their coal use has quadrupled from the figures I'm reading, so I'm not seeing a lot of hope there either.
Yeah, China has become kind of the best of times and the worst of times. They keep building coal plants and as such have become the world's biggest emitter of heat-trapping greenhouse gases. On the other hand, I just posted today on Climate Progress that they are going to add 500 gigawatts of new renewable power by 2020. So they are going to be, they're going to be both the dirtiest and the cleanest country in the world. It's kind of weird in that regard.
Could go either way. What is your take on the climate negotiations in Cancun, Mexico?
Yeah, they're going on now. They've been going on for a week. I think the prospects of a major deal are quite limited now because, you know, the United States can't deliver on its commitment. There was a meeting a year ago. Every year is another conference of parties. And there was one in Copenhagen where Obama, people may remember, came in and negotiated at the last minute a very high-level deal with other leaders. And it was very impressive, but it required the U.S. to deliver on a 17% emissions reduction by 2020, and that would require, almost certainly require, a legislation that's not going to occur. So the U.S. isn't prepared to act. Obviously, many other countries have been questioning this, including, you know, Canada seems very unlikely to act. Also, we have to face the realistic prospect that all that you're going to see is sort of more bite-sized activity. And by bite-sized, I mean we're only going to see limited agreements in things like forestry, in perhaps some deals around money to support international adaptation. Now, the good news is a lot of businesses have come to Cancun, and they are prepared to put money into action. So I think you're going to see action in this country at the state level. A lot of states, like big states, California just elected Jerry Brown, who's a very aggressive supporter of clean energy. New York State just elected Andrew Cuomo, who's a very big supporter of clean energy. So, unfortunately, we're not going to see the kind of national action that we need, but I think you're going to see a lot of individual players step forward, and you're going to see remarkable and steady advances in clean energy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm happy to have Joe Rome as our guest. Yesterday, Joe, a friend picked me up in his car. It was very comfortable. Like most people, I was well fed. I thought to myself, this easy life will just go on until it can't. So what's wrong with keeping it all going as long as we can?
Well, you know, that's on climate progress, I called that, you know, this is the global Ponzi scheme, where we keep basically living off the future wealth of our children. You know, it can't keep going on forever. I think it's clear that, you know, one can certainly have a certain amount of denial, but the reality is that we're not making any more oil, so peak oil is coming. And the only reason oil prices aren't at record levels is because we're in a global economic slowdown. But oil prices are going to go back up, and I think you're going to see things like food prices go back up as commodity prices go back up. And then on top of that, the reality of climate change, I think, is becoming more and more obvious to everybody. So there's no question that I think sometime, maybe not in this decade, but by the 2020s, you are going to get, I think, kind of desperate to reduce emissions, and the world is going to change at that point. I mean, I think, obviously, the climate is changing. I mean, that, Canada experienced dramatic climate change this year, including at the Olympics, where they had to airlift in snow. You know, the Arctic is warming up faster than anywhere else on the planet. We had a fifth of Pakistan was flooded. You know, Moscow was hit with a once-in-a-thousand-year heat wave, drought leading to wildfires. They stopped all grain exports for the year. And like I said, this is just from about 1 degree Fahrenheit warming in recent decades. So inaction doesn't stop climate change. And what I often say is we are going to change into a clean energy economy. There is no escaping that fact because, A, we're not making more fossil fuels, and, B, the consequences of inaction will become sort of more and more palpable. The only question is whether we do it voluntarily and do it in time to avert, you know, the kind of catastrophic impacts that are laid out in that Royal Society special issue, or whether we do it, you know, kind of after the fact, and we suffer the consequences of serious global warming.
Well, we've all seen the flooding in Pakistan on the TV and China, but very few people seem to know that Ecuador just proclaimed a national emergency due to an extreme rainfall event, and Venezuela is struggling with flooding right now. I think this is one of the underreported stories of climate change, extreme precipitation events. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the extreme precipitation events get reported. It's just that no one explains the very basics of it, which I, you know, have tried to do on Climate Progress, interviewing people like Kevin Trenberth, the head of climate analysis for the National Center for Atmospheric Research, who makes clear this is a very basic prediction of climate science. As you heat up the planet, you put more water vapor into the atmosphere, and that water vapor gets swept into these large superstorms and then gets dumped as more extreme rain events. So in this country, Nashville got a once-in-a-thousand-year rainstorm. Many cities, as you say, have been just totally swamped by these staggering amounts of flooding. So yes, there's no question, for the foreseeable future, the biggest impact on most people of the warming planet is going to be these extreme deluges and downpours.
Joe, you're at the center of a whirlpool of climate information, and some of it makes my jaw drop. Much of it is frightening or upsetting. What sort of stories keep you up at night?
Well, I'm very concerned about the oceans, because I think, you know, we're basically clear-cutting the oceans, but because they're underwater, nobody sees them. We peaked in fish harvesting globally over a decade ago. So there are a lot of people who are very concerned that we are passing the carrying capacity of the planet. Now, rich countries, the U.S. and Canada, we have a lot of money, and I think Americans and Canadians are going to suffer along with everyone else. We're just more well off, so we'll be able to deal with it better. There are billions of people around the planet, particularly by the middle of the century, who are just going to be in places like Bangladesh, where seas are just displacing their homes, to places in India and China, which rely on the glacier melt from the Himalayas, which is going to drastically diminish. They rely on that water. Sub-Saharan Africa. There's a whole article in the Royal Society paper on the impact on agriculture in Sub-Saharan Africa of climate change. So, you know, what keeps me up is the science is clear. Humans are warming the planet. The climate is changing just as people, scientists predicted decades ago. It's going to get much worse if we don't take action soon. And the most frustrating thing to me is, because I worked at the U.S. Department of Energy for 5 years, is that we have the technologies. We still need to keep doing research and development to improve technologies for the next generation, but we need to start deploying the energy efficiency technologies, the solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, at a much faster rate than we are now. The technology is there. It's really the political will, unfortunately, that is lacking.
So you think we could still power a worthwhile civilization without fossil fuels and without going back to the Middle Ages?
Well, I think there's no question about it. I mean, I think people need to understand we don't have to go to zero emissions tomorrow. We just need to steadily reduce our emissions over the next, let's say, 3 or 4 decades. I'm not saying, I never say that it would be easy, but it definitely would be straightforward. Many independent analysts, including the International Energy Agency, have explained that the cost is literally just 2 or 3% of global economic wealth. But that cost doesn't disappear. It just goes into, instead of investing that money into dirty, polluting, inefficient forms of energy and infrastructure, you put it in clean, efficient forms of infrastructure. That's what gets you on the path to reducing the heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel combustion. So it would take a lot of effort. But, you know, like I said, we are definitely going to be doing it. I mean, during the lifetime of most of your listeners, I don't have any doubt that we are going to make this transition. It's just if we start the transition aggressively now, we could really avert the worst impacts of climate change. If we dawdle for another 10 to 15 years, we're going to place such a tremendous burden on our children that we may cross tipping points that simply you can't cross back from.
Could you tell our listeners the best ways to approach and use your blog at climateprogress.org?
Well, I have tried to set it up so that it can be a place where people track I think people need to become educated on this issue. If they care about the future, if they have children, I think it's important. I think their kids are going to live in a changed world and are going to want to understand these issues and indeed be trained in key areas like clean energy, because that's going to be one of the big growth areas in jobs in the coming years. I've set it up so that I follow the news regularly. I blog on clean energy. I blog on climate science. I blog on politics. I try to cover international things. I try to write on Canada. In fact, I recently had a contest, what would Canada look like in 2050? So I try to keep it lively that way. I try to have some humor because this is a tough subject. The blog has been highly recognized. Time magazine recently named it one of the top 15 blogs in the entire country on any subject. If you go to the site in the right-hand column, I have a list of sort of introductory posts to key issues like economics and solutions, and I have some key science posts listed. So it's a good site to get up to speed on the key issues and then to follow the subject.
How long have you been doing it?
I have been doing this for a little over 4 years now. I have 36,000 subscribers to my feed and another 15,000 or so people who show up every day to read the posts. So it's very rewarding. There are a lot of people out there who want to stay on top of this issue. And the other key thing is I have a great community of commenters. People often remark that about I try very hard to keep out the people who spread disinformation, keep them off of the comments. And as a result, I have a lot of scientists and leading environmentalists who comment on the blogs. And so some posts will have 50 to 100 comments in which people will explain, just sort of give their opinion, what they're doing locally. And so it's kind of a community of sort of climate hawks is the big term, by the way, that David Roberts had a little contest. What should people call themselves who care about, you know, climate and clean energy? And everyone seems to like the term climate hawk. So the climate hawks come to climateprogress.org to follow this issue.
Well, it's true. I've had a little education on various climate issues, not just from your blog posting, which always has lots of links that head off to the original science or statements, but also from the comments. There's lots of good stuff in there. As we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add, something important that we've missed or a message to leave with us?
I think people do need to become informed and take action. What that form of that action, I actually had a little query to my readers over the weekend. What should you ask people to do? I think the first thing is become informed on the subject. I think it's worthwhile to try to green your home. You'll find that it can save you a lot of money, and it's not going to change the world, but it's the kind of thing that allows you to, A, when you talk to your neighbors, explain, hey, I did it. It's not that hard. We all can do it. This is an important subject. But I think the key thing is become informed and sort of find your own little niche here. But ignoring the problem is not going to make it go away and is not a solution.
You have been listening to Dr. Joseph Rome on Radio EcoShock. He's the author of Hell and High Water, Global Warming, The Solution in the Politics and What We Should Do. And he's definitely the world's best climate blogger in these momentous times. Joe, thank you for sharing your time and insight.
Hey, thank you.
Radio EcoShock.
The Royal Society in Britain, the country's most prestigious institute of science, has issued a new series of papers on our climate prospects. The theme is 4 degrees and beyond. Official scientific circles, including some government advisors, now seem to almost admit mistakes were made, but they're saying climate scientists underestimated the sensitivity of our ecosystem. You may not yet have been told the severity of the changes to the atmosphere and the oceans that we triggered with fossil power. David Wasdell told us that years ago. I couldn't believe it then. Now I do. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thank you for your welcome.
Everyone was talking about 2 degrees of warming as the upper limit we could have. Now diplomats at Cancun say even that target is no longer possible. Can we survive 4 degrees and beyond?
This is a very timely question, Alex, because it's a two-edged sword. Many of the scientists and published papers over the last 3 or 4 years have been indicating that even 2 degrees is quite a dangerous level to go to. And in the papers that you've been mentioned, that have just come out from the Royal Society's journal, it's been made very clear that 2 degrees is not the threshold of dangerous warming, but the boundary between dangerous warming and extremely dangerous warming. So we have to put that as part of the context of where we're going. But back to your question itself, can we survive 4? Is 2 degrees possible to achieve? The papers that you describe from the Royal Society are saying with the current sets of promises and the current outputs of greenhouse gases, the likelihood of being able to hold a temperature increase to only 2 degrees, even though that is the boundary of extremely dangerous change, is very small indeed. A conference here held in Oxford University about 15 months ago, on which these papers are based, looked at the probability of temperatures reaching 4 degrees globally, 4 degrees increase, that is, on the pre-industrial level. And that is, it's survivable in the sense that life will go on, humanity in some form would survive, but the impacts of that and the consequences of it almost don't bear thinking about. The other thing that is absolutely crucial here is that the promises made for the Copenhagen Accord do not in any sense give a foundation for achieving the 2 degrees. They don't even give us a foundation for achieving the 4 degrees. They're way off target even for that. And judging by the way Cancun is going at the moment, and we're right in the middle of it, it doesn't even look as if those promises themselves will either hold or be implemented. So we're facing a massive, massive problem at a global scale.
You've also told us that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, was not good enough. What sort of institution do we need?
It's a difficult question again. You don't know how old Google is. The IPCC is the most extraordinarily complex and competent bringing together of science around a particular problem that the world has ever masterminded and put together. To say it's not good enough is a very difficult value judgment. I don't think I've ever actually said that. What I have pointed out is that the papers that they review in putting together their 4 yearly reports have to be in the published domain, they have to be peer-reviewed, and that means there's a delay between publishing material and it getting into the IPCC documents of about 2 years. And then when you think that it takes 18 months for the Intergovernmental Panel to produce its report, having gone through its assembly process, so that when it comes out, it's already perhaps 3 years behind the leading edge of published material. And I think what the Royal Society's Philosophical Transactions Special Edition, which is the one you refer to, has done, is brought that time delay down by about 4 years. So this is leading edge stuff. It's a year old. There's a delay in getting the material together. But even that isn't right on the button. So somehow we need an institution that creates real-time, leading-edge climate science and its implications and applications right up to date. And that needs to be available for policymakers, decision-makers around the world. What that looks like, everybody's scratching their heads about. But that's what we need.
But I think that, you know, to try and come up with a group that's going to get a consensus approval by even the greatest oil exporters like Saudi Arabia, and that's going to be a problem. There's been a call that the IPCC should not be have any activism to it. We need some sort of command center. We need some sort of group that's on the job full time, paying out scientists all the time, getting some action to save us. Does that relate to your idea of Apollo Gaia?
The constraints on action that we're meeting in the world at the moment are phenomenal. If you have a massive population addicted to heroin, and then there's a major movement to deal with this as a massive social problem, you do not give power to those who produce heroin, who profit from it, who push it, the drug barons, if you like, and the mafia, who take massive economic kickback from the addiction. If you put those into positions of power to manage the detox program for the group, they will get nowhere because there are huge vested interests in maintaining the addiction. That's very similar to the situation we're in. There are major corporations, nation states, national economies, international procedures, pension funds, the whole fossil fuel industry, the electricity generating industries, the coal producers, to name just a few, we could add in, of course, aviation, transport, automobile industries, and all the investments that depend on them. All of these see that effective action to limit the use of fossil energy would be like killing the goose that lays the golden egg. And they will mobilize goose protection procedures for all they are worth, and they have done so to huge effect, to block action on climate change that would undermine the profitability of managing the addiction. So what you're raising raises the whole issue of the dynamics of action in a world that is caught going two ways. One, a sustainable planet demand that lives within the boundaries of a viable ecosystem. If you like, our life support system is under threat. We need to solve that problem. The other one, the survivability, if you like, the sustainability of the profitability of using fossil energy. And those two are at war. And that war has immobilized the United Nations procedural processes. It immobilized Copenhagen. It is at this very moment, as we speak, immobilizing Cancun. I don't think a command center can be put together with teeth to implement a control and command program at a global level.
I saw your presentation to scientists at Talberg, Sweden in 2008. You say it's a mistake to look at temperatures only as a way of judging where we stand now in global heating. Can you explain?
Yes, that's right. I said this back in 2005, in fact, in my approach that was taken up by the Club of Rome way back then. Temperature change is a consequence of climate change. The causal thing is the new heating being applied to the Earth's surface. So if you like, it's about energy. You could have a very large room with a huge kettle of ice in the middle, and you can start pouring energy into the room, heat into the room. But the room temperature doesn't change very much with the initial heating. It takes a lot of energy to melt the ice and do other things, and then the temperature begins to respond. The Earth's even more massive and inert than that. So what we're looking at is the amount of energy per square meter that we're taking up at the Earth's surface because of the greenhouse effect, the fact that we're blocking energy going back out into space and therefore trapping more of the sun's energy close to the surface. That amount of energy is changing things in the Earth. It's melting ice. It's changing ocean currents. It's changing all sorts of processes in the climate, one of which is temperature. We can monitor temperature, and we've been doing that, and we can see it going up quite fast, and then going down a bit, and then going level for a bit, and then going up again, and then down again. The overall trend is upwards, but there's a lot of variability in it. And over the last 4, 5, 8 years, I suppose, the rate of change of temperature has been fairly low, because a lot of the energy has been going on into ice melt. We've seen a lot of change in the ice fields in the Arctic and the Antarctic. It's gone into evaporation. There's a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere. It's more moist and humid. And the energy has also gone down in terms of heating the deep ocean, which is where a lot of the energy goes. So global heating continues unabated. The temperature goes through sort of wiggles. And if your temperature at the moment is anything like the anomaly that's happening here in Western Europe, people are saying, global warming, you have to be joking. But in fact, the other side of the world, the sea temperatures around Manila and the Philippines are about 10 degrees above what they should be, as are the sea temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico. And you get these shifts in local conditions, which you cannot use really to generalize about climate change. But the temperature profile, I feel like a secondary signal among many of what's going on in the energy equations of planet Earth.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.